This episode of Shutters Inc. is brought to you by Hedge for Mac, your best resource for data backup on OS X. It's the fastest, safest backup routine for your video, photo, and audio assets with full bit-perfect copy and verification. Go to hedgeformac.com/shuttersinc for more info and to obtain a 20% discount exclusively for Shutters Inc. listeners.
This is Shutters Inc. with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 345 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from ShuttersIncPodcast.com, and for the first half of this episode, it's just going to be me by myself. Glyn ended up, his week just got out of hand, and as we knew, he was flying off to the US this week, so we weren't able to record earlier this week, and I think he flew out on Thursday, so it's just me. I've got a fair bit of stuff to cover, but later in this episode, I'm going to be talking with Kate Breslin from localaventurer.com, and I won't tell you any more about it. I'll let her do that when we get to it. So, things to cover this week. As you all know, this subject of raw file size has been a real thorn in my side over the last few weeks, and I was very interested to get to the bottom of why raw files should be different sizes. Now, Walt Kippenhuck sent us an email through the week, or it was a comment via the blog, and he said, "Hi Bruce, Glyn, on the topic of raw image file size, I myself have noted a fairly significant difference among my images. I think the reason might be fairly straightforward. If I'm shooting a 24 megapixel camera, the 24 million pixels represent the high watermark for data capture on my sensor when I capture an image with a full dynamic range. Ever blow out the highlights? Underexposed shadows? In the more extreme cases, detail can't be retrieved for either of these even when shot in RAW, simply because there's no data there to use. Does this sound crazy? Just curious. I'm not saying I know this to be the ultimate answer for this quandary, but I thought it was a salient point. Let me know what you think. Walt." Walt, thank you very much for the thoughts, but no, I'm respectfully going to disagree with you. And the reason I'm going to disagree with you is because imagine a 14-digit number, right? I'm using my A850 as a reference point here, shoots 14-bit RAW files. So imagine a 14-bit number, right? That is a number comprised of zeros and ones that is 14 characters long. Every one of those characters can be a 1 or a 0. And the number of potential values between 0000 to 14 places and 111111 to 14 places is 16,382. There we go. 16,382 potential 14-digit numbers between all ones and all zeros, right? And those numbers represent all the shades of grey. You know, where let's assume that all the ones equals black and all the zeros equals white. And every number in between represents a different shade of grey. It's irrelevant whether you blew highlights or clipped shadows, because those pixels will register either all zeros or all ones, right? The fact that there's no value there to us as a viewer doesn't change the fact that there is still data there. And that data has to be stored and retrieved and processed if we want to turn the RAW into a JPEG, right? So the quantity of data is still fixed. So that's why I disagree. However, I posted this quandary on Facebook, on the Sony Alpha group on Facebook. I sent a message to the moderator, said, "Hi, this is who I am. I run a podcast, blah, blah. We've been talking about this for a few weeks. Do you know anyone that can accurately explain why these RAW files are coming out different sizes?" And a guy called David Kilpatrick came back and he said, "I can answer that. Uncompressed RAWs are the same size. Losslessly compressed RAW shows small variations, and lossy compression produces greater variation. The size of any compressed RAW, and most are unless you can specifically set uncompressed, is determined by the level of sharp detail and the noise level, mostly a result of ISO setting. So if you photograph a plain blue sky at 100 ISO, the result should be close to the smallest raw you can get. If you photograph something like a tartan tweed with loads of texture and color variation dead sharp with a macro lens, that will be bigger. And if you use 6400 ISO, it'll make it bigger still, except that many camera firmware processor setups will change the bit depth at higher ISOs. Sony does this with single shot versus high speed sequence. 14-bit depth, larger RAW for single shot mode, but 12-bit depth, smaller RAW for continuous shooting. Depends on camera model too. But the main reason for varying size is the compression used at any given bit depth and how this responds to more granular information as opposed to flat, smooth information. Wow! So that blew me away on a couple of fronts. One, I had no idea that Sony implemented different bit depths for RAW capture depending on the shooting mode. Now, I'm going to have to investigate further as to whether or not the 850 is, you know, one of those cameras where that is employed as a technique. I did have a quick flick through the owner's manual and I couldn't see any reference to it shooting at a shallower bit depth if you were in continuous shooting mode. But I'll have to investigate that further. But that's fascinating. But the other side of this, the idea that pretty much all of the cameras are shooting some type of compressed RAW. Now, I know we discussed this, and I was under the impression that my A850 was shooting uncompressed RAW. But after another exchange on Facebook, David came back with, because controversially, Sony compresses all RAW files. CRAW is a special, which stands for compressed RAW, for those who are not Sony shooters, is a special bit depth fixed variant. RAW in the 850 and 900 is a secretly compressed RAW. It's not pure. This caused a lot of complaints. It's still better than CRAW, and in my experience was better than certain other makes which claimed totally uncompressed RAW. They got the same flack when the A7 R2 was released, with RAW being secretly compressed, that is, not labelled as a compressed RAW. So they had to update the firmware to add uncompressed RAW as a choice to keep everyone happy. So there we go. I think we can put this topic to bed now. I'm satisfied now that I at least understand that there is a certain level of lossless compression being applied to the RAW files that my A850 takes. And that explains the small variations in file size between shots. So, yeah, this has been a very interesting topic. And thank you, everyone who's weighed in on it. As you know, I'm a bit of a geek and, you know, that kind of thing just, yeah, stuck in the corner of my mind going, no, this doesn't make sense. They should all be the same size because it's the same quantity of data. It doesn't matter what the values are for each pixel, it's still one more 14-digit number that's got to be, you know, included in the maths and therefore should weigh equally in the file size. So if there's compression happening, that explains it. We heard via the Facebook wall from Tony White, who sent us a link to a story on Petapixel about a plugin called, I'm assuming it's pronounced Exire. It's spelt E-X-C-I-R-E, and basically this is a plugin for Lightroom which will catalog all of the images in, it will read all of the images in your catalog, and it will identify different things within your images. Yeah, so it's basically doing image recognition, and it will then tag keywords into the metadata based on what it has learned about your images. The blog does say you'll need at least 10,000 photos to see the benefits, and the initialization will take around about 1 hour for every 10,000 photos in your catalog. So, yeah, very interesting. I'm going to have to download that and give it a look. So, thank you, Tony, for that one. I then heard from Steve Peters with a story on fstoppers.com called The Tyranny of the Travel Photographer. And this is written by Dylan Goldby about some disturbing practices that he's seen in his travels of people who are, you know, on holiday and wanting to take photos. And it's an interesting read. I haven't read all of it, Steve, but thank you very much for the link. And the link will be in the show notes for anyone that wants to check that out. Through the week, I saw a story on my Facebook feed from Popular Photography about Gregory Heisler on portraiture. And I think the reason this sort of jumped out at me was the fact that the image that came up was a portrait of Bruce Springsteen that Heisler had shot. So I had a read. It's a great little interview, and there's a couple of points that I just wanted to bring out. Getting over that awkwardness of posing people really can be one of the most challenging things about portrait photography. If worst comes to worst, one little piece of advice I can give is to tell your subject that he or she needs to move every time you click the shutter. I don't care what they do. There might be 25 horrible pictures before you get a good one. Then when you find something you like, tell them to stop. Let them settle into it. If they don't move around, you'll never get the opportunity to see the thing that works. I thought that was really valuable advice. And there was another little bit. There's a terrific photographer, Sam Abell, who shoots for National Geographic a lot. And his mantra is compose and wait. He actually finds his frame and waits for things to happen within that. I try to build on that. My mantra is sort of compose and make shit happen. Laughs. So yeah, it was a good interview. I highly recommend it for anyone that's interested in portraiture. I also heard from Peter Sambell through the week, and he said, love the critique Glyn gave on Bruce's model shoot. Great info to assist all of us who do not do much off-camera flash. I know you were talking about drones a few episodes back and wondered if you'd seen the winning shots from a drone contest. Pretty amazing. And he's provided the link to a Huffington Post article, which will be in the show notes for anyone that wants to see them. And yeah, there are some great images in there, particularly the first place winner for the sport and adventure category in the rock climbers in Moab. That's just fantastic. Anyway, go check them out. Rob Coates weighed in and said, Glyn's condemnation of Googled street photos because most of them are black and white reminds me of the old lady watching the soldiers marching past on Anzac Day and saying, would you look at that? My son's the only one in step. Thank you, Rob. Carl sent us the link, the biggest mistake each camera manufacturer has made. And this was a story on petapixel.com, and it's essentially leveraging off a video by Tony Northrup. I will summarize it for you. Canon's biggest mistake was choosing a slightly smaller APS-C sensor with a 1.6 crop factor when everyone else is using a 1.5x crop factor. Nikon's biggest mistake was not investing in proper live view focusing like on-sensor phase detection technology. Sony's biggest mistake was abandoning A-mount SLT system in favor of their full-frame E-mount system. Although there has been a very, according to Sony rumors, or Sony Alpha rumors, I'm not sure what the website is now, I'll find the link, there is quite a plausible rumor floating around that there is an A-mount full-frame successor to the A99 coming very soon. So they rate their rumors depending on the source, from one being pretty much unbelievable through to five being highly credible, and they gave this a rating of five. So obviously the source who's leaked it is someone who either has been very good with their rumors in the past and that they've come to fruition, or it's somebody who works, you know, somewhere very close to the source. So, yeah, so that'll be interesting to see. Pentax's biggest mistake, the K1, because while Northrop loves the camera, Pentax now has to develop an entirely new line of full-frame lenses for the new full-frame system. Panasonic and Olympus's biggest mistakes, he lumps both Micro Four Thirds manufacturers together, saying that their biggest mistake is not investing in phase detect autofocus technology. And there's more to that story. I'll let you go and read it to get it all in full. Okay, before we go to our interview with Kate, it's probably time for David Marlin to step in with another book review. David, take it away.
Thanks, Bruce. If I ask photographers to name a famous wilderness or landscape photographer, most people will think of Ansel Adams. And if I say wilderness photographer, Yosemite, the Sierra Club, people again will say Ansel Adams. And Ansel was certainly a great photographer and contributed enormously to the recognition of photography as an art form, particularly photographs taken from life. But in fact, I'm actually not talking about Ansel Adams. I'm talking about another landscape photographer, Galen Rowell. Galen was unfortunately killed in an aircraft accident in 2002. He was a mechanic who became a world-class rock and mountain climber, a world-class photographer and writer. He wrote articles in magazines, he wrote books and photography books, he prepared essays and did assignments for National Geographic. Unlike Ansel, Galen worked in colour and did very little, if any, post-processing, mostly using ND filters, if anything at all. He also included people in his landscapes, which makes them rather special. The book I'm talking about is called Galen Rowell, A Retrospective. When you open the book, you encounter six successive double-page stunning photographs. One is of the gates of the valley at Yosemite with winter sunset, an Alaskan brown bear, rainbow over the Patala Palace in Tibet, fall colours and dry pond in northwest Canada, moonlight in the Himalaya, and one of his climbing friends, Conrad Anker, on Mount Sill in California. These six photographs encompass the wide range of Galen Rowell, and all are stunning in their own right. The book is interspersed with not just his photographs, made on a Nikon, and covers the years from the 60s until 2002. Till 1990, he used Kodachrome, and from 1990 on, he used Velvia. So he didn't actually use wide ranges of films or equipment. The chapters just follow themes of his life. There's a photo critique followed by chapters on his mountain work, the expeditions he went on, his work on conservation in the wild, Asia in particular, Galen Rowell as an adventure photographer, and his landscape work. And the chapters themselves are interspersed with short essays with particular photos. One that stood out for me is on, for those that might already have the book, is the one on page 213. It's an essay called The Difference Between Looking and Seeing. And it relates to a photo called Basaltic Formation, Chang Tang Plateau, Tibet, 2002. The essay talks of how the picture was captured during a trek across the Chang Tang Plateau. All four of the trekkers walked past these rocks, but only Galen stopped and took a photo. Only Galen saw the rocks, and that's the difference. He saw things while others looked. So the lesson for all of us is really, do you just look at things you go past, or do you truly see them? It's something for all of us as photographers to think about. The book's available online at multiple outlets at around $60 US plus postage. A softback's also available. But it is really is a glorious coffee table book. A site worth visiting is Mountain Light Photography, which was also set up by Galen. Great value and something to really get you thinking as a photographer. Cheers.
Thank you, David. Interesting that you should choose a book about Galen Rowell. Long-time listeners to this podcast would remember that Shelton was very much a big fan of Galen Rowell and his work. And I know that prior to Galen's death in 2002, Shelton did actually get to meet him and shoot with him down in Tasmania. He always spoke very highly of Galen's work. So, yeah, thank you. I will do my best to find some links to where you can find that book around the web and include those in the show notes. It's about time that I mentioned that this episode of Shutters Inc. is brought to you by Hedge for Mac. Hedge is the fastest app for importing and backing up your media on OS X, photos, videos, and audio files. It is the most stripped-back, no-nonsense interface you'll see. It's a fantastically simple, yet really powerful under the hood. One of the features that I really like, and I mention this every week, the ability to import from multiple sources and copy to multiple destinations simultaneously. I think that's fantastic. You know, in this day and age where, you know, it's quite likely that you'll have a DSLR where you've got one memory card for shooting stills, but a different memory card for capturing your video footage, you could have both of those cards mounted to your Mac and be copying the data from both simultaneously, not just to one location, but to multiple locations. You know, we've spoken endlessly about the need for multiple backups of your data. So the idea of being able to import from two cards simultaneously and copy to multiple destinations, I think is fantastic, just to help, you know, speed up your backup routine. And it does this with Hedge's Fastlane technology. It's the fastest copy and verification engine you'll find on the Mac. It's even faster than Finder. It's optimized for files 100 megs or larger. That's because originally Hedge for Mac was purely for video stuff. But obviously, you know, now we've got DSLRs that are shooting video. And obviously, as DSLR sensors get bigger, RAW files are going to get bigger and bigger. It probably won't be long before we're getting 100 megabyte RAW files. Every file copied by Hedge is cross-verified with the original. There's full support for NAS, RAID, and for uploading to various cloud services. And you can use scripts to sort, transcode, rename, and tag your media after import. If you'd like a 20% discount, check out hedgeformac.com/shuttersinc. And we thank Hedge for Mac for their support of this episode of Shutters Inc. Okay, so I guess it's about time we got Kate Breslin on the line from localaventura.com, localaventura. There is no D in there. Localaventura.com. Welcome aboard. Welcome to Shutters Inc.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, Bruce.
Thank you. So Kate is the Chief Operating Officer and co-founder of localaventura.com. Kate, do you want to explain to us how did the company come to be?
Sure, I would love to. So basically, we had a bunch of friends who wanted to go to Latin America, and they always just found it really difficult to have these awesome experiences. So they were concerned about safety, about finding the right things to do, about doing something authentic, and, you know, they would show up with thousands of dollars in USD and just kind of hope for the best. And so, but I had lived there. I had studied abroad in Buenos Aires. My partner, Drea, is from Chile originally, and so we knew that there were all these amazing things to do here, and we wanted to make that accessible to basically every traveler who is interested. So what we wanted to do was create this platform where people can come, anyone from around the world can come, search on our platform, pick the tour or the activity classes that they want to do, and book them and pay all in one place. So what really distinguishes us from other people in the space is that we actually go on every single one of the tours before we consider even adding it to the platform. So we really have a very rigorous vetting process for each of our guides, and we really put the spotlight on them. So on our website, you can read the biography of the guide before you even go on the tour. You can learn about their dream vacation, their passions. So you really feel comfortable knowing the person that you're going to be spending your time with and that they're really a local person who can give you a very authentic experience. So really, it was about facilitating those local connections and the really authentic experiences throughout all of Latin America. That's what we really wanted to do. And that's I feel very confident that that's what we are doing now.
Nice. So at the moment, you guys cover Chile, Argentina, Peru, Uruguay, and Brazil.
Yes, we actually, we also just launched in Costa Rica and Panama, and currently I'm in Mexico, so we'll be rolling out new tours there very soon.
Wow. Yep. So you pretty much got all of South America covered.
Yeah. No, it's been awesome because basically I graduated from university and then immediately moved to Buenos Aires.
Right.
And like literally just like a couple of weeks later. And with that, just a one-way ticket, not knowing how long I would stay for, if I would go to another country. So then I moved there. I went on a bunch of tours like every week, meeting with the local guides, finding out their needs as guides. And then I moved to Santiago in Chile. Then I was in Brazil for a while, and now I'm in Mexico. So yeah, I've been moving around quite a bit for the past year.
Wow. With regards photography, what do you cater to photographers specifically, or is it more just focused on people that are interested in having a great South American experience?
So I would say that we actually have really great offerings for people, you know, photographers of varying skill levels or experience. So even professional photographers can come and meet with our local experts yep. in these different places and have an awesome time. And what they can do is show you the local places through, the best places from a photographer's perspective. And so I wouldn't say that we have a particular focus on photographers. What we really have a focus on is authenticity and really having that special local experience.
Nice.
So, but of course, photography is so crucial to travel. Travel industry is so motivated and inspired by the visual
yeah.
that, and I personally, like I was going to tell you earlier that the first job I ever had actually, literally delivering newspapers in Philadelphia. The first thing once I had money that I bought was a camera, and I bought a DSLR. That's true. Like the first thing I ever really purchased with my own money in my life was a camera. So I've always really, really loved photography. And when I went to South America for the first time, I documented it very heavily.
Nice.
So that was important to me that we had an awesome offering for photographers in particular, because I view it as I said, a really important part of travel is to document it and to have those memories in kind of physical form.
Yeah. Now, I've noticed that the tours that you guys are running mm-hmm. vary in length from
yeah.
some are just a couple of hours and
yeah.
some are multi-day, multi-night.
Yeah, it's awesome. So there are some places that are more suited for those kind of all-inclusive type of things. For example, if you want to go trekking in Patagonia in Chile, then it's really not something that you can do for a couple hours. It's really something that we would recommend doing, for 6 days, something like that. There are varying, lengths of treks. You can do the W trek, which is very traditional in Patagonia. And then we do have these kind of one-off tours. So the photography tours are more like that. So, for example, our guide, Bernardo, in Buenos Aires, is a professional photographer. And we actually recently had a professional photographer client come, and he was looking for a photography tour. I was like, okay, well, it was actually the first time that we had a customer book the photography tour in Buenos Aires.
Right.
And he wrote us back an email that was just gushing. He was like, it was the highlight of my entire trip in South America. Like,
wow.
Bernardo and I are now best friends. Like, thank you so much for connecting us. So I feel really confident and obviously, like, we went on the tour with him, but I'm not a professional photographer, and now that a professional photographer has gone on the tour with him, I feel like very, very confident in offering it, and anyone with really any level of skill would enjoy it.
So let me put you on the spot.
Yeah.
Did you learn anything that you can apply to your photography while you're on the tour with him?
Yeah, I think the number one thing is actually that I took away from that tour in particular.
Yeah.
Was to have the idea of a theme, which is really cool. Because
okay.
I kind of talked to him more generally. Obviously, like when we go on these tours, we ask him a bunch of different questions because we want to make sure that they are able to answer the questions if our customers ask them some.
Sure.
So I kind of said like, hey, what kind of advice do you give to frequent travelers basically who want to capture their travels or their journeys? And he said that having a theme was really something cool. So maybe like photographing cafes in different cities that you travel to, or maybe you want to do just door frames or photographing rivers in all the different countries that you go to. It's really cool to look back on those type of photos.
Yeah, right.
And kind of view your adventures with that kind of consistent element.
Sure.
I thought that was really good advice from him.
Yeah, right. Awesome.
Yeah.
So have you... I mean, obviously, you're not going on every tour. You're managing the tours that you run. But have you heard any horror stories of people trying to bring too much gear with them?
No, I haven't. I honestly haven't heard that.
Okay.
But I think that it can, and this is something that I often think about, is that you don't really want to be bogged down while you're traveling with a bunch of equipment, and then you're like trying to balance enjoying your time traveling, enjoying the moment with also like documenting it. So something that I do personally when I'm traveling is that I actually set aside time where I can go out by myself. Like, let's say I'm going to go for a solo walk on the beach or something. And that way I know that I'll have time to take as many photos as I want. I'll bring my equipment with me if I want to. And that way no one else is also annoyed by that. And that way, when I'm with actual people, I can enjoy the time with them, you know?
Yeah, nice. I try and do something similar on our family holidays, yeah, because my wife is not a mad photographer like I am. So,
yeah,
you know, I try
not everyone gets it. Or not everyone is as interested, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she loves looking at my images after I've shot them, but she's not always interested in standing around for 20 minutes while I do a, you know, 10-stop exposure.
Yeah, exactly. So we need to have our own time to do those things. And I think that's like, to set aside that time, maybe in the mornings you wake up before everyone else and you go out and get the sunrise or something.
Yeah, for sure.
I think that's a good tip, yeah.
Cool. And so how do you choose your guides? Like, obviously they're not all photographers, but how do you choose them?
We actually have a spreadsheet that is a scrape of the entire TripAdvisor website. So that's one thing that we use. We go through that. We go on their website. We go through the reviews. So what we try and look for is guides that have amazing reviews, but not that many of them.
Right.
So that way we know that they're amazing guides, or we think they might be, and they're still like maybe struggling to get a lot of customers. Because one of our goals is really to economically empower these guides, because they're incredibly entrepreneurial, very talented, but they're not, you know, necessarily great at marketing themselves. They're not necessarily great at managing, you know, their money or accepting payments, things like that. So the idea with Local Aventura is to really let them do what they love doing, what they're passionate about, and then we kind of handle the rest. We do the marketing, the technology, the payment and booking platforms. So the way that we do it is we look at those reviews, and then we reach out to so TripAdvisor is just one way. We also, you know, word of mouth, recommendations from family and friends, Instagram, Facebook are also great ways to, and just Googling in general. We really try to cover all of our bases to make sure we've gotten all the best guides. And then from there, what we do is we email them, we explain ourselves a little bit, and we say, like, we'd love to talk to you on Skype for a little bit and see if it makes sense to form a partnership. If that goes well, then we'll schedule a tour with them. And then we end up accepting about 20 to 30% of everyone that we interview.
Right.
So it's pretty, it's pretty curated, our platform. We only, you know, they have to speak excellent English. They have to be really knowledgeable. They have to be really customer service oriented, very passionate. So that's really the process that we're using now. And we've kind of gotten it down to a science at this point, to be honest. We were able to launch in a new country and, you know, maybe 1 month is probably sufficient for us.
Right. Wow.
Yeah, it's fun. It's really fun, actually, to travel to these different places and meet with these local people and hear their stories as well. It's awesome to be able, because I know that so many friends and family want to have these experiences in Latin America. And so now that I've met these people, I'm like, okay, wow, like, Sophia would be amazing for you. Like, I know that if I would recommend it to one of my friends or family, that's also kind of a question we ask ourselves. Would we actually pay for this tour? And so if we would actually recommend it to a friend or family, then I think it's good enough for the platform.
Yeah, nice. And there's certainly a lot to be said for having a local guide who knows the local area. My wife and I did a tour with our son as well, to Borneo.
Oh, wow.
About 3 years ago, and we went with Intrepid, and just having, you know, that tour guide there who knows, you know, the area that you're in and, you know, can steer you away from, you know, parts that you maybe shouldn't venture into on your own or,
exactly.
You know, things like that. It's certainly valuable information and not something you're necessarily going to find just by Googling. I mean, you might, but, you know. It's certainly handy having a local on the ground who understands the area.
Exactly. And a lot of the really cool things is that our guides can take you to places that you would never see in a guidebook. So, like, as much as people read these Lonely Planet and Frommer's guidebooks, like, they're just things that they miss, right? So, and also, of course, doing it the safe way is really important. Especially in Latin America where, you know, some neighborhoods you just want to completely avoid. So I really recommend, if possible, experiencing a place with a local is just like, it's so much better. You know, it's much superior to just not knowing, because what ends up happening, to be honest, is that these people, they end up opting for sacrificing authentic experiences and opting for the easy one, which is doing the hop on, hop off bus,
right,
or something like that. And for us, the hop on, hop off bus is kind of like the epitome of what we're trying to avoid.
Yeah.
Or what we're you know, it's just like, okay, you're literally, there's a physical barrier separating you from the rest of the local culture, you know? So it's just, we're trying to get people to avoid those things and more engage with the local culture.
Yeah. And I think certainly speaking for myself, the idea of a bus tour is just, for the guy who loves photography, mm-hmm. I would find the bus tour to be so restricting because I'd be constantly looking at things out the window going, oh, I want to stop. I want to photograph that. And you can't, you know?
And that's my
wife and I are going to Europe for 5 weeks next year. And, I said to her, I said, look, I don't care what we do, but we're not going on a bus. You know, we got to hire a car or buy a car or do something, you know, because I want to be able to stop whenever I see something I like. And she was like, yeah, okay, fair enough.
Yeah. And then if you're with a guy, they're obviously always willing to like, okay, you need to use the bathroom. Okay. You want to stop for a photo, like making sure that the place is safe to stop in. Yeah. Yeah. It's just so much better.
So, are there plans for localaventura.com to spread beyond South America, or are you quite happy maintaining that niche?
So what we view, I guess our plans for the future are that our business model can really be applied in any emerging market. And so we've actually bought the domain rights to localadventuring.com,
right,
the English version. And so, you know, eventually, we're really concentrating on building a great presence, being the trusted travel go-to, you know, platform for all of Latin America, really being the experts. And then once we feel really great about having a solid presence in each major Latin American destination, then we would consider expansion to places, other emerging markets such as India, Africa, maybe Eastern Europe, which is also really, really exciting because
yeah.
These are places where tourism is not developed, and so going there can be really hectic. It can be really frustrating. People spend hours and hours and hours. It might as well be a full-time job with the number of hours that some people spend trying to plan their travels. And the thing is, like, if you haven't been there before, you can look on the internet as much as you want, but who knows what you're reading is really reliable.
Yeah.
And so what we want to do is be able to help facilitate those adventures to emerging markets. So starting with Latin America, because I think that's really where we had the local expertise. And I've actually been to India before, so I would personally love to, like, you know, one day expand there.
Nice.
Yeah. So it's really exciting. We'll have to check back in a few years.
For sure. For sure.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Was there anything else that you had on your list of things that you wanted to discuss?
I had prepared some travel photography tips, but I think that yours would be way superior to anything that I could potentially offer.
No, look, you know what? I'm keen to hear them. Absolutely keen to hear them because everyone has a completely different approach. You know, the whole thing about photography is it is an art. It's very personal. It's very subjective. And you know, you can always learn from other people regardless of experience. And, you know, listeners to this podcast absolutely understand that, you know, no matter what your level of experience, you just don't know who can share something with you that you've never considered. So, no, I would absolutely love to hear your photography tips.
No, I mean, okay, they're not like technical tips or anything like that.
Sure.
It's more about thinking about photography. So one thing that I was kind of considering was when you see, you know, a very ideal photo of places like Machu Picchu or you know, very world famous places,
yep.
You don't realize how hard it is to actually get that photo that's not filled with tourists. That's the thing. In addition to like actually getting a perfectly framed shot of Machu Picchu, the other thing is that these places are so incredibly full with, you know, so many other people, like the Taj Mahal, for example. I remember when I went there, obviously I was the only, I was actually one of very few non-Indian people there that day. And so it's a very funny photo. It's me standing there smiling and literally everyone behind me staring at me. But, so I think something interesting to consider is when you take the photo, trying to think about what you want that photo to represent. So if you're trying to make a commentary on maybe like how travel has changed, maybe you're okay with including those tourists taking with a selfie stick taking a photo, you know? Maybe that would be an interesting, you know, juxtaposition next to ancient Machu Picchu with the... With the very modern selfie stick. Or if there are, you know, maybe some native Peruvians, then, you know, that would be something that would be interesting to photograph as well. That's something that's more authentic. So I think kind of considering those things is something to, you know, the perception of the place is going to be changed depending on the photo, the people that are included in the photo.
Sure.
So that's something that I was thinking about that would be interesting to, for your listeners to potentially consider. And then I guess... The rest of what I wanted to say is pretty basic, so I feel a little embarrassed to.
No.
It's no. The only thing I was going to say is I've kind of touched on before is the idea of themes, because yep. I've actually incorporated that into my own personal photography. Just trying to keep something consistent across all of the places that I've gone to. It's just interesting to think about the differences, compare and contrast them. Also having photos of you in similar poses or like in similar places across different countries could be interesting to compare how you've changed, you know? So maybe like standing in front of a monument in Buenos Aires and then another kind of similar type of statue in Mexico City and just seeing how you've changed from that time to the next.
Right.
Something that I like to do. And then just thinking about how photography has really changed over the years. So all the photos of me as a child, for example, like not one of them is a selfie. It's all like me and my brothers standing in front of a stadium or something, you know, or me and my parents, you know, standing in front of some beautiful landscape. But nowadays, the way that people capture their travel memories is by with these selfie sticks and with these selfies. And is that inherently bad? Is it? Maybe it is.
we could open a whole can of worms on that topic alone.
I think that's for another episode, the selfie stick.
I think the interesting point that you make, though, about, you know, when you were a child, there were no selfies, I think can be tied back to the fact that in those days, we were still shooting on film. There was no such thing as digital photography. And film was expensive. Processing was expensive. Printing was expensive.
Yeah.
So you tried to make sure that every time you clicked the shutter, it was going to be an image worth having. What digital has done for us is given us the ability to shoot like madmen with the finger on the trigger nonstop.
Exactly.
And not incur any real economic cost, mm-hmm. you know, beyond, you know, maybe extra, you know, flashcards.
Yeah.
And I think that is what has given rise to the whole selfie phenomenon, you know, is the fact that, hey, I can take, you know, 5 frames to make sure I get, you know, this selfie right. Mm-hmm. Where in the film days, and given that, you know, with a film camera, you probably only had 36 frames per mm-hmm. roll of film, you weren't prepared to sacrifice a fifth or a sixth of that roll of film just to get one selfie. And I think that's probably why we're seeing, yeah, the selfie phenomenon that we are.
Although, I completely agree. I think that it's very true. And one thing that I actually noticed when I was going to the Taj Mahal in India, I saw a photo of George Harrison taking a selfie. Like, it was a selfie taken by him in front of the Taj Mahal in, like, 1968.
Yeah, he could afford the rolls of film.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I don't think he was worried about the cost of another roll of Kodak somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Also, in that photo, there were no tourists behind him, so he could probably pay to like have them all removed, you know?
Yeah.
But I think those are just like a few things to keep in mind. And I guess the only thing I would say is if anyone of your listeners is actually interested in coming to Latin America, we offer 30 minutes of free travel advice. It usually turns into like over an hour, to be honest, because we get to talking about all these great places. But it can be really overwhelming to try and think about planning a trip to Latin America.
Sure.
And so what we do is try and be as helpful as we can with the knowledge that we have. And so we have these calls with people, no matter where they are at the stage of planning, whether it's an idea or they already have their flights booked, and try to give them advice on not just obviously on what things to do, We've been living here, so we know, you know, where to get your money exchanged, where to stay, what restaurants to go to, what things to skip out on also. So, if anyone's interested, they can.
So when you say you offer a complimentary 30-minute call, you mean like Skype?
Yeah, it would be Skype or on the phone or a Google Hangout, anything that they would prefer. We could give them a call wherever they are.
Just to put this into perspective in terms of time, we're recording this in August of 2016, and Google Hangouts are scheduled to be killed off in the next 30 days. So Google Hangouts is only good for another month, but after that, who knows? So where can people find the details of how to contact you if they want to have that complimentary call?
Yeah, they can go to our website, localaventura.com, and then... Or they could email us directly at founders@localaventura, and it's localaventura.com. You can email us. We have a WhatsApp number, a phone number. We have we also have a live chat on our website, so you could even do that if you want.
Cool.
Even if you don't end up using us, we're always happy to facilitate travel to Latin America because it's such an amazing region. There's so much to do. And so if we could help in any way, we're always more than happy to do that.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
All right, Kate. Well, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Bruce. This has been wonderful. I look forward to connecting in a few years.
Yeah. Well, look, we'd love to hear back from you. And certainly, you know, as you open up other markets, you know, let us know because we'll always share that information because that's a benefit to our listeners to know, you know, where you guys are operating. So thank you.
I will definitely do that. Thanks, Bruce.
No worries, Kate. All right. Well, that wraps it up for this episode of Shutters Inc. Glyn is obviously away for the next couple of weeks. I will try and organise a co-host for next week. And until then, take care.
ShuttersIncPodcast.com.
Another audio-to-you.com quality podcast.
For questions, comments and feedback, email theboys@ShuttersIncPodcast.com.